If you were a housewife back in March of 1938, or if you drove a taxi cab, or ran a gas station, or were an artist, a seamstress, an off-duty policeman, or just a youngster home from school with a cold, and if you listened to the radio, and who didn't in those days, you might have heard this.
Well, sir, it's late afternoon as we enter the small house halfway up on the next block down. And here in the kitchen, we find Mr. Victor Gook and his son, Mr. Rush Gook. Mr. Victor Gook has drawn the kitchen table over by the sink where the light's the best, and he's doing a spot of office work at home. And Mr. Rush Gook, who just this moment arrived from school, removes his cap and overcoat. Listen.
Not through there, guy?
I am through with the actual labor. All I have to do now is copy some figures neatly on a sheet of paper.
It's all right if I talk then, huh?
You go ahead.
Mom's upstairs?
Mom's next door, chewing the fat with Ma Donahue. What's on your mind?
I've been doing considerable thinking about the party we're going to have a week from Saturday.
Reach me my eraser. I dropped it on the floor.
That party was taken right out of my hands, you know.
Yeah, so I understand.
Here.
Thanks.
Mom started out by making me official host. The party was to be in honor of Nicer Scott, and I was going to be in charge of all arrangements.
Uh-huh.
But she figured too many people would have to be invited, so she decided to leave out the kids.
Uh-huh.
And took over the arrangements herself.
You see the good sense of that, don't you? We can't get the population of the United States in this modest dwelling.
No, just the same.
What exactly is your beef?
If I could be reinstated as official host, I'd put on a party you'd hear about.
You have my sympathy, crab meat, but I don't see what I can do about the matter.
Well, I was thinking maybe you could persuade Mom.
To reinstate you as official host?
Yeah.
It's hardly in my department.
You'll be present at the party a week from next Saturday. You'll want to have a bang-up time, won't you?
Sure.
The plans I got worked out would guarantee you a bang-up time.
That's so?
You'd have so much enjoyment you'd never forget it.
Tell Papa.
All afternoon I've been running stuff through my head.
You went to school this afternoon, didn't you?
Yeah, but I never paid much attention in class. My mind was busy on sensational arrangements for this party. I got sense worked out people will talk about for the next 50 years.
Sounds like you plan a social function of a rather ambitious nature.
I do.
Reach me my eraser again, will you? It seems to be all butterfingers today.
You know what the party will be like if Mom gives it, don't you?
No, what?
Here's your eraser.
Thanks.
Dull.
The party will be dull under your mother's management?
Well, maybe dull is a harsh word.
Maybe it is.
Maybe ordinary is better. The people will come here. They'll hang their hat and coat in the hall. They'll all go in the living room and sit down. They'll talk back and forth. After a while, Mom will whip out ice cream and cake. They'll talk a while longer. Pretty soon they say goodnight and go home. Party's all over.
That setup don't appeal to you, huh?
No. It's like everybody else's party. There's nothing different about it.
Let's hear some of your ideas.
Can I expect cooperation from you if I confide in you?
Cooperation?
Will you try to persuade Mom I ought to be reinstated as official host?
Well, frankly, Margaret, I don't think I could so much wait. Your mother's decisions on matters like this are generally pretty cut and dried.
Well, you could try. You could come whooping in all excited and slap her on the back and say, by golly, Sade, that Rush sure has rung the bell. He's got stunts lined up for this party a week from Saturday that'll make you jump over the People's Bank building. The basketball cheerleader, Nate Crabtree, wrote a sentence on the blackboard at a pep meeting we had last week. Sentence was, enthusiasm is contagious.
Enthusiasm is contagious?
Enthusiasm is contagious. And that's supposed to be true. Look, pretty soon Mom will be home. Suppose when she opens the door, you jump out of your chair like a skyrocket and say, by gosh, kiddo, that doggone Rush has got stunts doctored up for this party a week from Saturday that'll make you swallow your shoes. Enthusiasm is contagious. Work it right and you'll have Mom reinstating me as official host in 40 seconds.
What are some of these stunts of yours?
Got them right here in my pocket, wrote down on a piece of paper.
In the past, Melon Seed, I've noticed you're apt to show a tendency to lean towards impractical extremes. I approve of the happy fires of youth and all that, but I've reached a conservative age.
Listen to these.
Okay.
Two physicians and three trained nurses in constant attendance.
How's that?
If I'm reinstated as official host of the party, I'm going to have a platform in the front hallway. On this platform will be five chairs. In the chairs will be seated two doctors and three nurses, all dressed in white.
What's the idea?
Suppose somebody gets sick at the party.
Why should anybody get sick?
Some might eat too much ice cream. Others might get exhausted laughing at the jolly jokes. You can't ever tell. People are human beings and liable to get sick any minute of the day or night.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it gives class to a party. Innocent bystanders downtown will be saying, "Hey, Walter, hear about the big social function they had on Virginia Avenue. Two doctors and three nurses was hired to keep eye on the kids."
Hmm.
There'll be a piece in the newspaper. One of the most stylish events of the whole pleasure-crazed social season was given last night by Mr. Rush Cook of Virginia Avenue. Among those present was, and so forth and so on.
Got any more fancy features?
Got plenty. For one thing, I'm going to call the fire department.
You don't contemplate livening up the party by setting the house on fire?
Oh, no.
I was somewhat apprehensive. I love to see people have fun at my home, but I draw the line.
Here's the angle. Along about 9:30 in the evening, party's kind of sagged. Appreciate the angle I'm attempting to put across. Different guests start yawning, and the official host begins to get desperate. He wonders, what the heck could I better do to put some pep in things? Well, I got that problem solved. I'm going to telephone the fire department.
False alarm?
Sure. Everybody enjoys watching fire wagons. And these fire wagons will stop right in front of our house. Great sport for everybody.
I have a discouraging note.
Yeah?
There's a severe penalty for turning in false alarms.
Is there?
10 years in jail or something. You can see for yourself that while the fire engines are coming here on a false alarm, a real fire might break out somewhere and make it disagreeable all around.
Yeah. Well, guess I better cross that one off my list.
Might be the best thing. What's your next step?
There'll be a policeman in uniform at the party. He'll walk around among the people all during the evening and sort of keep an eye on things.
You're afraid our guests will steal the spoon?
No.
What are you afraid they'll steal?
Nothing. The policeman will just be an ornament. He'll add tone to the party. Keep order and see that nobody makes a disturbance.
Very fashionable.
Ain't it, though?
I imagine the people we invite to the party will be greatly flattered.
Sure.
Of course, I hope your policemen don't find it necessary to hit any of our friends over the head with his billy club.
Oh, he won't do anything like that. He'll just mingle with the crowd. Of course, if groups start ganging up in doorways and stuff, he'll come along and holler, break it up, in a friendly sort of way.
Hmm.
That ought to get printed in the newspaper, too. Among the stylish features at Mr. Rushcook's big social event Saturday night was the presence of a police officer who prevented riots and various other crimes.
Hmm.
Hot stuff?
Yeah. Tell me more of your plans.
All right. Here's the big super special stunt. Everybody's going to get tattooed with my compliments.
Tattooed?
Yeah. There's a tattoo fella that's just started up business down on West Evans Street. I'm going to hire him to come out here the night of the party and tattoo all the various guests.
You going to tattoo pictures on him?
No, words. In memory of the finest social event I ever attended, Mr. Rushcook's party, March 12th, 1938.
Hmm.
How you like that?
It's certainly different.
Another idea of mine is to have 35...
I believe that's all I got time for now, Harriet.
Going someplace?
Yeah, got these figures all copied. Think I'll stroll down to the office with him.
Well, will you work on mine?
Sure.
Persuader I ought to be reinstated as official host at the party.
Okay.
You can say for yourself, I'll really put on a social function if I get the chance.
No doubt about it. What you gonna do now?
Telephone Rooster Davis. He'll be greatly interested in my various things. 4678J, please. Correct. I can trust you, can't I?
What do you mean?
Not to be telling my plans around town.
Oh, sure.
I'm gonna bind Rooster to secrecy.
I won't breathe it to a soul. Well, your mother gets home before I do. Tell her I've gone.
Okay.
So long.
So long. Hello, Rooster.
This is Gary Owen. Back in the days when radio was king, there was one daytime radio program standing so far above those around it that it provoked such an intense admiration among its fans that it still dominates some of their lives today, almost 30 years after it left the air. One of those so affected is Jack Foster, who took his tape recorder and drove some 10,000 miles collecting recollections of the stars of Vic and Save. This program is the result of that expedition. We wish to thank those who participated for giving their time, and Mary Frances Reimer, widow of Paul Reimer, who was the author of Vic and Save, for her help. Mrs. Reimer is editor of a volume of Vic and Save's scripts called The Small House Halfway Up in the Next Block. Now here is Bob Arbogast to take us on a little trip to The Small House Halfway Up in the Next Block.
Vic and Sade was a daytime radio program created by Paul Reimer that was on the air from June of 1932 until September 29, 1944. It was not like any other radio program ever. This is a tribute to Vic and Sade. Well, sir, it's late 1972 as we visit the small town halfway up in the next state now. The mistress of the menage is seated at the kitchen table, relaxing over a cup of coffee and reminiscing about the days when she played the part of Sade in Paul Reimer's remarkable radio program of the 30s and 40s. Let's listen.
Unfortunately, the bulk of the audience had to be women because of the times the program was heard. Artists, and then people in the theater, were great fans. The engineers. You heard much more about it right around the studios from the men than you did the women. I remember we would hear from judges. There was one judge in New York State, and he would get off the bench and recess the court and go into his chambers to listen to Vic and Sade. I think it's true. I think if it had been on for any length of time at night, the men would be the ones who would be more vocal about it than women. Women would delight in it, but they wouldn't say, "Oh, I remember well." You know, when that happened at our house.
That was the voice of Bernadine Flynn as she sounds today. We're taking a conversational tour of reminiscences of Vic and Sade in an attempt to recapture for fans of the old radio show something of the flavor of Vic and Sade and of the personalities who together made Vic and Sade the wonderful, unique thing that it was. The Vic and Sade theme that we heard a moment ago is the way Clarence Hartzell plays it on the organ. Here's the way he remembers Uncle Fletcher.
You remember Miss Gilfop there in Dixon and her married daughter Fern, don't you, Sadie? Well, Miss Gilfop was the Dixon girl that had the brother to fall off in a five-story building and still live there years ago. Had a brother. Her brother's name was Richard, Yin-Yang Richard. He recovered from falling off that building, moved to Fresno, Colorado, married a woman within 3 days of being 22 years old, went into the dead or alive horse and mule business, and later died. Now, here's another picture, Sadie. You'll never guess who this is. Emmett Chowning. The reason I say you'd never guess who he is because he only stayed in this part of the country 5 minutes and then went back to the state of New Mexico where he came from. Emmett Chowning left the state of New Mexico and come to Dixon, Illinois because some relatives had promised him a job. He got off the train, got homesick, began to cry, climbed back on the half-wit train, went to Davenport, Iowa, changed cars at that community and headed back for New Mexico. Only 5 minutes he lingered in Dixon. Me and this relative of his were the only ones that even saw him. All the way across the country from New Mexico, Emmett Chowning was happy as a horse. He was going to Dixon to take over a good job. But he no sooner got off the train than homesickness set in. He sobbed like a baby. The conductor hollered, "All aboard!" And Emmett Chowning climbed back on the train, lingered in Dixon 5 minutes, and only 5 minutes. Teaches us a lesson, don't it?
Bill Idelson, who played the part of the boy Rush, is now a writer and television producer on the West Coast, currently producing The Bob Newhart Show.
One of the great historians, was it Henrik Van Loon? I think it was, said when the show was on the air that this is the greatest piece of Americana that's being produced in the United States today. This show is real Americana. And it was. You know, now, for the last 12 years, I've been engaged in writing comedy shows for television. And I've seen a lot of comedy material, so I think I have some perspective on comedy talent and comedy quality. And I don't think there's ever been anything like Vic and Sade. And I don't say that every day's show was great, but the amount of innovative, original kind of comedy that came out of it, none of it was derivative that I know of. It was all the expression of a really unique personality, and that was Paul Reimer, a completely fresh, unique way of looking at the world. I'm just in awe of it, and I'm more and more in awe of it the more that I see of comedy as it's being produced today. Well, in going back to the University of Wisconsin and going over these thousands of scripts, I didn't find them dated in the least. They were as fresh and as wonderful now as they ever were, and they have that kind of timeless quality that real writing has. And I think they will live in some form or another. I'm delighted that those scripts are still available, and I think one of the greatest crimes of the century was the fact that the recordings were destroyed by Procter & Gamble. And I think that makes me burn every time I think of it. I think this was short-sighted, and it was absolutely unforgivable.
Bob Brown was a staff announcer at NBC in 1932. He was asked to announce a new family comedy that had recently gone on the air.
The show started when, I don't really remember, but it started with a little phrase, Welser. Well, I was the one that coined that phrase, because Paul wrote originally an opening, as we approached the little house halfway up in the next block, and he set the scene so that you knew exactly what's going to happen after you got in the house. But I always felt that there was an abrupt quality of coming in as we approach. And I wanted something that was perhaps I don't know whether the word is bucolic, but I guess it is, as warm and rural Americanish as a phrase like Welser. And I went to Paul one day, and I said, Paul, would you mind if, when I open the show, instead of going into it cold, after I come out of the Crisco commercial, to pause a moment and then say, Welser, as we approach... You know, I said it's a transitional. It's like a conjunction from the commercial to the show. And he said, no, it's fine. So I introduced that little phrase. It's my only claim to fame on Vic and Sade was that.
Vic and Sade was taken off the air in 1944. Later, an attempt was made to revive it. It was put into a new format, 1.5 hour in length. Many of the townspeople whose names were famous to listeners but who had never been heard were given voice. Chuck and Dottie Brainfeeble appeared, as did Pelter Unbleak and his imaginary brother, both parts played by Butler Mandeville. Roy Delfino was played by Forrest Lewis, and Dwight 26er, who always went around with his mouth full of shingle nails, was played by Cliff Subir, who also played Mr. Gumpox, the garbage man. Rush's friend, Bluetooth Johnson, was played by Leonard Smith. Another actor who played several parts in that short series was Johnny Coombs, who later became known as Uncle Johnny on Chicago television.
One of the highlights of my career was the opportunity to work on Vic and Sade. I thought that was one of the greatest shows that was ever on the air. Paul Reimer, who wrote that show, was a genius. And Paul was such a wonderful man and had the ability of being able to write for a specific person once he heard him. Of course, they didn't bring the characters to life until later in the middle 40s when they did a half-hour version. Actually, they did a 15-minute version first for Procter & Gamble, where they brought characters like L.J. Gertner and Mervyn S. Sprawl and Smelly Clark and Orville Weenie and Harry Dean and Richigan Fishigan from Sichigan, Michigan, and Roy Delfino, who could rub his bare feet together and produce a clear blue flame and light his cigar. And they had all these characters that were given voice.
L.J. Gertner was the city water inspector. Yes, Mr. Gook. And I'll see you at about noon tomorrow morning. Thank you very much.
And then there was Mervyn S. Sprawl.
Yes, my name is Mervyn S. Sprawl. My daughter brought me over here to get some of the peanuts with the chocolate smeared on the outsides. My shawl's slipping. I was born in Pittsburgh. Yes, Indianapolis. I was born in Indianapolis.
Every city they mentioned, he was born there. And then there was Orville Weenie, who was one of Rush's pals.
I live just down the street here. Yeah, my name is Orville Weenie. Hi, Rush. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, about 15 or 20 minutes, I'd suspect. All right. Bye, Mr. Gook, Miss Gook.
And then there was Smelly Clark, who was another friend of Rush's, and he sounded, if I can remember, it's been a long time.
Hi, Rush. Yeah, it's Smelly. Okay, you gonna play baseball this afternoon? All right. Is Uncle Fletcher gonna be there? Yeah. Well, I thought maybe he could be the umpire. Yeah, okay.
And then there was Harry Dean, who Harry Dean just came in and out once in a while, and he was sort of a brush.
Hi, Mr. Gook. It's Harry Dean. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, we can handle that for you. All right. Yes, sir.
But for one reason or another, Vic and Sage just didn't seem the same in the new format.
I don't really think they gained anything by bringing these characters to life. Because, to all intents and purposes, you thought they did talk. You heard so much about them that you never realized they didn't talk until they started talking.
Yes, but it wasn't successful, and neither was the television show successful. It was a bold attempt, but it didn't... On the television show, well, there were two versions of that. One, they tried to create the characters. But it didn't last long. It wasn't the original cast either, as I remember.
I think Paul, when he first conceived the show and started writing it, he wrote it with three characters only for several reasons. One was that it was economical. It saved the network a lot of money. It was a sustaining show, and we only stayed on for 2.5 years sustaining because it was such a cheap show to do. I got $27.50 a week, and Bernadine and Van, I think, got $35 or something like that. And so the economics were part of the reason why Paul made it a three-character show. But I think there was also an artistic reason why, and it was because he was creating characters that really did not exist in life as they were portrayed. They were a little bit bigger than life. They were a little more outrageous than life. They were really caricatures in some way, and there is no human voice in the world that could exactly duplicate these characters, represent these characters. And Paul made these characters do the most outrageous things, and he could because you never actually heard them. They were only told about, so the imagination filled in the rest of it. It was radio going one better on itself. You not only imagined what was being said, you imagine things that were not being said. You imagine people that weren't heard. So that Paul did a unique thing there. He created a whole town of people that were never actually heard. And yet the audience knew these people as intimately as they knew the ones that spoke. We would get laughs on things. We would say about something that, tell about something that some character did. And we would get a laugh because people say, that's just like him, that's just like him, and they had never heard that guy. But the characters were so completely drawn just from references. And we would get laughs on people's phone calls, one-sided phone calls, where you only imagined what the other person said. And Paul's one-sided phone calls were so skillful. The things that were said by the characters on mic were so perfect that you imagined what the other person said, and there was always in character, in this outrageous character.
And I remember I had a sister living in Chicago at the time. Well, she loved Vic and Sade, and we talked nearly every day on the phone. One time, I was on the show alone. Paul did that. He had me on a telephone talking to Ruthie Stembottom. They just gabbed, lady talk, you know. The wash rag sale at Yamilton's, the brick mush man, and the letter she just got from her niece, Yuncy, who played the piano with... She got to where she could run her fingernail down, up and down, the black keys, you know, and all that. And Walter's kneecap had let up considerable on the twinges. And she had to tell Ruthie all those important things that had happened. So when I talked to my sister that day, I said, well, how'd you like the show today? And she said, I loved it. I just loved it. And I said, who'd you like best? She said, what do you mean? You all fit together so well. Well, I said, now, I'm not asking for a compliment here. I just want to, you know, some days one sort of has the lead and the rest is fill in. Now, which one stood out to you? Oh, she said, dear, I don't know. I said, Lenora, there was nobody on the show but me today. She said, oh, no, that's not true. I don't believe it. I said, you did hear it. Did you hear the whole thing? I heard the whole thing. I never miss it.
But no one could. They tried to bring it back with different people, and it was not successful because they couldn't. There's no way they could simulate these people. They were so firmly entrenched in the American minds that people would not accept it, I'm sure. And it was not the same thing.
Well, I think here's a prime example of trying to convert into reality the things that are so much better left to the imagination. I know Amos and Andy tried to do it when they tried to cast the movie or the TV series of Amos and Andy, and while I think some of the characters were wonderful, certainly Andy was in the TV series and the Kingfish and Madam Queen, Amos never came across. I never felt that Amos had any character, because I had my own image of Amos, and I had my own image of Vic and Satan Rush. Even though I knew the people, I had another on-the-air image of Vic and Sade, which is a totally different thing. Also, I had images of what Mr. Gumpox and the other people looked like, and when I heard somebody cast and reading as Mr. Gumpox, no, I'm sorry, he never sounded like that to me, and I can't believe him. They never appeared, and you didn't care if they had never appeared, because I could see Robert and Slobber Tinks right now, and all those people, they were real. Bluetooth Johnson was real to me. Ruthie was real to me. All the people that people the story were real.
They used to have a live audience for the evening one, the half-hour version. And I went down there once or twice. But I never liked it. Maybe it's because I was seeing it and not just listening. But I think the bringing in of other characters didn't help it. Reimer couldn't write to that. He really wrote for that 10 minutes. He knew how to handle that kind of a time frame, I think. I don't think, you see, when it went to a half an hour, he had to introduce other characters and so on, and I don't really think that was his game.
That last voice was Franklin McMahon, the noted Chicago artist, who was a friend of Paul Reimer and a devoted Vic and Sade fan. At a meeting of the Art Directors Society of St. Louis, McMahon spoke of Vic and Sade.
Julius Williams, he listened. He remembers the tiny petite pheasant feather tea shop. Sade and Ruthie Stenbottom used to go to the Yamilton's to buy wash rags, and on the way back they'd stop off at the tiny petite pheasant feather tea shop, and that's what Williams remembers the most about him. The central fact of Vic's life was that he was exalted Big Dipper in the Drowsy Venus chapter of the Sacred Stars of the Milky Way. And he was a member of the All-Star Marching Team. This marching team had chapters from Dismal Seepage, Ohio to East Breen, Oregon. But the trouble is they could never get together, so they'd march separately in each town. He had a friend in Lester, Nebraska, Y.Y. Flurch, and Y.Y. Flurch was forever getting hit with fast passenger trains, and Vic would get a wire from J.J. Sunbolt, who was Y.Y. Flurch's friend, that he'd been hit by a fast passenger train. This would happen every couple of months. Another guy who lived in Vic's town and was a member of the lodge was Richigan Fishigan from Sishigan, Michigan. Uncle Fletcher had a friend who was an armed guard at the Ohio State Home for the Tall. Well, in the program, the Bright Kentucky Hotel was by the railroad track. And when the fast trains came through from Chicago to St. Louis, the hotel would shake. And Gumpot the garbage man lived in this hotel. And when the trains would go by, his bed would shake and he'd move across the room. So they put a longer train on between Chicago and St. Louis. And his bed moved right across the room and out down the hall. There's one circumstance in which he waves bon voyage, you know, to another guy who's coming by from the other way.
We've heard a sample of the voices of the people Foster was able to contact for our conversational tour. We'll continue after a 5-second pause for station identification.